This is CliffCentral.com.
Yeah, it's Coldplay with Beyonce and him for the weekend.
I don't particularly. Never mind.
Go on. I want to hear where this is going. I'm interested. You've obviously had a thought.
I don't like this song.
Share your thought. What is it, Babs? Come on.
I don't like the song.
You don't?
No.
Is that all you wanted to say?
Yeah, that's all I'm going to say.
What's the like?
I was going to say, oh, shut up, Ben. You know, God, you are curmudgeonly. I think Daniela found this job in Cape Town so she could get away from you for enough time so that she could still love you.
It is a contrived piece of partners.
Oh, bullshit.
Like Chris Martin sitting around going, you know, I've been listening to Beyonce for years. Oh. And she is going to complete me and vice versa. They couldn't give a toss about each other.
Would you be objective?
Put into a studio and go, right, guys, we're going to make some money. They're going to go, you're right.
No.
And she'll be like, okay.
God, come on. You know, you could say that about Katy Perry. You could say that about Miley Cyrus. You could say that about a lot of people.
I hate to break
First
you, Gareth. In 20 years' time, Beyonce and Katy Perry are going to be in the same category.
No. I don't agree. And I'm not a Beyonce fan like Sia, okay?
No, you're not. No one is a Beyonce fan like Sia.
This woman, you might not, and I don't love most of her music. And you said the other day, and I laughed, all the single ladies, all the single ladies. You know, she's got these cheesy bullshit songs.
Katy Perry songs.
But do not, but she's different to Katy Perry. She's a cultural artifact. This Beyonce she's broken into places that artists haven't gone before. Give her credit. You don't like her music. I understand. I don't like 90% of it.
I actually like Beyonce. She was amazing in Austin Powers. And I've never had anything against her as a person after that.
Austin Powers.
Yeah, but I mean,
Foxy Cleopatra.
No, but Ben, look. I don't know. I agree with Gareth here.
That's great.
Katy Perry is not in the same league as Beyonce.
Come on.
I don't think so, but when you get remembered for your impact of like hits and popularity because it's pop music, of course they're going to be in the same category.
But not on influence, though. I think that's what Gareth is leaning more towards. Remembered for influence.
Okay, you want to talk influence?
Beyonce is going to be like, she's going to have more points to score there.
Now she does. You remember that guy Bono? He had lots of influence, but no one gives a fuck about
him. All I'm saying,
he was also seen as a visionary.
Hold on, guys.
Time forgets.
Take Bono's music, and he did things with his music. I listened to that song, and you're doing exactly what people that you're criticizing are doing. You don't like it because it's Chris Martin and Beyonce. It's a good song.
That's not what I said. I said it's a contrived music.
It's not. It's a beautifully written song. Da 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 da. That's beautiful composition. There's nothing wrong with that. You don't like Beyonce and you don't like Chris Martin. Just like you criticize those people.
I don't
people.
Like Gwyneth Paltrow.
Exactly.
What does Chris Gwyneth Martin have to do with
come
this?
On, she's annoying.
Okay, yeah, but
she married Chris Martin, so this is the link. I've never once said anything ill of Chris Martin.
So,
we've revealed your true nature of your
I've never said anything
complaints.
Ill of Chris Martin.
You just called him contrived for someone
working
with...
The song
with
was contrived.
Here's Carl. Carl says, that's the only song I can listen to that features or includes Beyonce. It's great. Hate her music, but that song is great. Agreed.
Okay.
That's my whole point. Be objective. Ben, you're always criticizing people who are not objective when it comes to sport or when it comes to politics or society or opinions. You are not objective about the song because it's Beyonce and Chris Martin. If you heard that was anybody else, you'd go, that's not bad.
Did I start what is now turned into this monologue by saying, I don't like this song because it's got Chris Martin and Beyonce? I said, this song is contrived.
Ah,
these
to hell
two,
with you.
These right. two have come together enough. For money, not music.
I give up.
Look,
great song.
I
great song.
No, but Gareth, you know what? Just,
tremendous.
just keep putting words in my mouth as you like to do, because if that's your thing, that's your thing. I'm not going to stop you.
I could not fit words in your mouth. There is no space.
Doesn't stop you in the past.
Oh, sure. Shame. You're so underrepresented, Ben. You have no way of expressing yourself.
Now you want to go into... No, poor
Ben.
I'm fine.
So poor victimized Ben. He doesn't have social media. He doesn't have a huge following. He doesn't have a great blog. He doesn't have a great show. He doesn't have his own show. He doesn't participate in this show and get a chance to open his mouth wherever he could. It's always poor old Ben. Gareth just shuts him up. Must be so hard for you.
Yeah, that's also what
cry?
I just said. Yeah. Yeah, that's also what I just
whiny
said.
Whiny little bitch.
Yeah.
Okay, that escalated very quickly.
No, we don't. We don't. I promise you, in half an hour, he'll be fine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I know.
I'm fine already. If do what you want to do in life, Gareth. You go ahead.
You know what I want to do? I want to talk to Ivor Fechter, but we'll get to that in a second. We are we're officially marketing and selling our own podcast wireless earphones, which, if you haven't seen them before, are a terrific idea for a gift for you or for someone else. You want to treat yourself, only 550 Rand. Go and look on the cliffcentral.com website, because you can compare this. I'm happy for you to compare it to any other products. There were lots of people doing that yesterday on social media. Tell me what you think. Tell me what you like about them. Tell me what you don't like about them, but try them. And all the specifications, all the features are listed on the packaging, and you can find out everything you need to know about them on cliffcentral.com. I think they're terrific because we had a really serious hand in how we designed them, what they looked like, how they worked. They are Bluetooth. Ben loved them. He put up a whole bunch of videos yesterday about them. So thank God we don't agree about Beyonce and Chris Martin, but we agree about these earphones. Mubs likes them because she keeps breaking earphones.
I still can't believe that story.
Yeah.
But it is kind of just you.
It was a different laptop that I was using, and I was walking, but I was in a rush, and my headphones were plugged into the laptop. And then as I opened the door to get into the next room, the laptop bumped against the door, and then the headphones broke off. But then the little piece of the headphone remains in that little port.
Jack.
And like the IT guys, they've been saying that they'll find tweezers to try and help me remove the damn thing, but it still hasn't happened.
It only could happen to you.
Yeah.
So there it is. Even Mabali can find a solution for this, and she's not the most technically adept person we know, just because she normally doesn't care. I'll tell you what we all care about. There's so much news this week to talk about. The Burning Platform, Justice Malala will be back next week. And I thought, let's get a commentator whose stuff I've been reading for years. He's a columnist, in his own words, on liberty and free markets, a prosperity monger, a knowledge dealer, a defender of the innocent, debunker of myths. And he's not for sale. But this morning he's here to give you his opinion. And I'm delighted to welcome to the show for the first time as part of the Burning Platform, which is brought to you by Nando's this morning, Ivor Fechter. Hi, Ivor. How are you, sir? Ivor, can you hear me? Hello. Oi, Palesa. Is there something I'm not doing right here? Ivor, are you there? Just see if you can get him on there, because I was so ready to talk to the guy.
Yeah.
Listen, he's written countless columns. He also is a regular in the Daily Maverick, among others. And this morning we're going to talk about a bunch of things. Let me give you a quick preview so you have some idea of what's going to come up here, because there's a laundry list. It's been a very busy week. So Ramaphosa is our president. He's only been president for a little over a week. What kind of a president is he? What sort of a cabinet has he chosen? What kind of contradictions and pipe dreams are there in Sona? And what about this expropriation without compensation that they've been talking about in Parliament this week that they've already voted on? In particular, what are the consequences for agriculture, for food security, and the possibility of violence? So there's a ton of stuff to talk about with Ivo. Can we try again? Ivo, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Absolutely loud and clear. How are you, man?
I'm very well, and you?
Excellent. I'm delighted to speak to you. I've been a long-time avid reader of much of the stuff that you write, and so much of it cuts through the crap, which is one of the reasons we wanted to have you on the Burning Platform this morning. It's been a busy week, Ivo. Where do you want to start?
It's actually difficult. I think the first thing that we should probably note, seeing as everybody seems to be so in love with Cyril Ramaphosa, is that we should not forget that he, or not think that he's anything other than a committed socialist.
Yeah.
That he thought it was okay to go and become a billionaire while, you know, millions remain mired in poverty just makes him a hypocritical socialist.
Right.
But a socialist he is.
So why would, I mean, if someone heard that for the first time and they thought maybe there was some kind of trendy millennial who thought there's nothing wrong with socialism, explain to us why that would be bad for a political leader in South Africa's context. And try not to use Venezuela. Try not to use Venezuela as an example.
Well, Venezuela is an excellent example.
Yeah.
The thing is that socialism always fails. You know, it's failed everywhere everywhere we've had it. Everyone has tried it. And people always say, oh, but that wasn't real socialism. That wasn't real socialism. They keep coming up with excuses, and they keep trying it again. And every new bunch thinks that they've got the way to promote socialism. But they basically all follow the same strategy, which in South Africa we know as the National Democratic Revolution. Mm-hmm. That strategy was sort of originally written by Marx, Lenin, and Engels.
Yeah.
But then the particular version the ANC uses was written in 1962 by the Soviet Communist Party. You know, so they all follow the same sort of strategy. And they all say, Bladem and Mzimande recently wrote that we had always understood the National Democratic Revolution as the most direct route to socialism.
Right. And the primary issue that some people might have with this is that it results in some kind of social engineering, which is what we've come from in South Africa with apartheid, where people were segregated, they were sent to certain areas, they were made to do certain kinds of work, and they were treated as different kinds of citizens. And that's essentially what socialism wants to do, right?
Yes, and that's really the problem. The government ends up deciding what you do, where you live, what you may do with your land, which you lease from the government, once it's expropriated, what jobs you'll do, what jobs are available. It becomes a sort of government decides, a very paternalistic central planning sort of state. It's weird. I thought it was very evil to very easy to oppose Zuma, the evil of Zuma.
Yeah.
You know, he was obviously evil, right? And even a child can oppose Zuma. I mean, the DA did, and it was very easy. The far more dangerous evil is that committed by a person who's intelligent and well-educated, who appears well-meaning, and who expresses his intentions with charm and charisma. Right. And that, to me, is the difference between Jacob Zuma and Cyril Ramaphosa. And of the two, I think Ramaphosa is far more dangerous.
Now, that's interesting, because most people were very relieved when Jacob Zuma resigned and that Cyril came in. And a lot of people thought, well, this is a guy who's an ally to sensible, rational policy. He wants a responsive and an effective government. I mean, it almost seems to me like we're tilting at windmills if we take it on the face of coverage that was given to him by the likes of the Mail and Guardian.
Yeah, I mean, the media was far too busy, being infatuated with him to actually critically look at anything that he said. The whole idea that he's going to have all these rational policies that are going to lift us out of our mire at the moment. Mm-hmm. If you just listen to his Sona speech, you'll see that there's a whole lot of contradictions there. I mean, with one hand, he promises to enact land expropriation without compensation.
Right.
Right, which would require a constitutional amendment to the property clause. With the other, once he's gutted the property clause, he says he wants to woo both domestic and foreign investors. Well, he can want whatever he likes, but what fool of an investor is going to bring their capital to South Africa if they cannot be sure that their property rights are secure?
And what kind of a fool is busy a week before he becomes president in Davos convincing everybody to invest when he knows full well that he's going to be undermining those property rights the very next week?
Yeah, no, exactly. It's he speaks from two sides of his mouth, and which is what socialists do. They make contradictory promises. They believe that they can do all sorts of cool things and have, they believe they can have their cake and eat it, if you like, in economic terms.
Let's talk about some of the other specifics he addressed in the Sona and break them down so that they're mm-hmm. understandable to all of us. Government investment funds for speculating in startups. I mean, government is not well known as being a good investor, even in things that it already supposedly understands, like Eskom and Transnet and the SABC. How could it possibly be a good speculator in terms of investing in startups?
I think it's an absolutely insane idea. I mean, startup investing is perhaps the most difficult and risky business you could possibly be in. Right? A bunch of rich people with experience in that sector sometimes do it. But there's a great chance that they lose their money. Mm-hmm. They invest slowly. They invest in tranches. Right. In the early days, quite a lot of the startups fall out. So the chances that they lose money is just insanely big.
it just takes a lot of skill, dedication, and attention to detail, right, which I don't believe the government possesses. What the problem is, in a competitive market, right, startup investors who fail, right, because they picked the wrong startups,
mm-hmm.
right, they only lose their own money.
Yeah.
Right? And then only the successful ones are able to continue to invest.
Right.
Now, if government assumes such a role, it won't face this kind of self-correcting competitive pressure. Right? Government can fail all day long.
And it's playing
millions after millions down the same drain.
And it's playing with our money, not their own.
Yes, it's playing with our money. You know, this is playing with money that should be going to social grants, that should be going to roads, that should be going to policing. You know, and there's absolutely nothing systematically that will put government under any pressure to turn these startups into successes.
Well,
other than maybe an internal target.
And haven't we already got a precursor to this and some kind of predictor of how this will go when we look at how the unions have invested union money into white monopoly capital, so to speak, and sometimes done very well, but for themselves as leaders of those trade unions, and sometimes done very poorly and lost their union members' money.
Yes. No, it's a risky thing to do.
Right.
You know, which is why it only should be done by private people with their own money.
Right.
Or with money that their owners at least put knowingly at risk.
Let's talk about the idea of buying local and protectionism in South Africa's economy versus the efficient allocation of public resources. And I'm quoting both of those from his speech. What do you make of that kind of language? Is it also forked tongue stuff?
It is. It's very strange, actually. I mean, do you remember when you were young? I mean, you're probably a bit younger than I am, but we were always told to koop Suid-Afrikaans.
Oh, was that the Nationalist Party?
Under the National Party. You know, we were told and taught at school to buy local.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, obviously the setting was a little bit different. National Party was coming under increasing sanctions,
mm-hmm.
so we had to kind of try and be self-sufficient. And, you know, of course, as the National Party, all gung-ho, we'll be self-sufficient. We don't need your imports.
Mm-hmm.
Koop Suid-Afrikaans.
Right.
Now, Ramaphosa promises the same sort of thing, right? But it's really nothing more than protectionism, because when local production is good enough, right, nobody needs to be told to buy local. Right? I buy lots of local groceries, right, because they're great. They're cheap. They fit my needs. Buying local when one would otherwise have bought foreign implies that you sacrifice either price or quality. So you sacrifice value. It artificially props up an uncompetitive local industry, which means that industry will never become competitive forever become remain dependent on sort of tariffs and subsidies and preferential contracts. So, by definition, buy local protectionism raises prices and reduces quality.
Hmm.
Now, Ramaphosa then said that he wants to efficiently allocate the resources of the state. Well, how do you do that if you deliberately raise prices and reduce quality of the things you buy?
Hmm.
I mean, that contradicts. That's another contradiction.
Right. What you make of, first of all, Nomvula Mokonyane being retained in cabinet when she's made such a mess? She and Batabile Dlamini, it can be argued, have been among the worst public servants. We know what kind of a state she's left the Department of Water and Sanitation in. And
yes.
What exactly is this Digital Industrial Revolution Commission? I mean, some of that sounds, first of all, we're way past industrial. This is language from the 1920s in Europe. Digital is not a word that goes alongside industrial in the first place.
No.
Revolution is the last thing you want if you're the government in power, which they clearly don't understand when it comes to the purpose of the word. And any commission in this country seldom achieves anything. So what is Nomvula Mokonyane going to wave the magic wand and do with the Digital Industrial Revolution Commission? Or is this,
I don't know.
Bullshit?
You're quite right. She should have been out on it. She dropped water and sanitation into a hole of debt, like almost 5 billion rands worth of debt,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is bigger than Limpopo had when Limpopo was put under administration, Limpopo province.
Right.
So she left that department in a complete mess and entirely unable. I mean, Helen Zille likes to think it's about politics, but the national government was entirely unable, thanks to Mokonyane, to respond in any way to the drought crisis. Right. There's projects on the go, you know, right now that are sort of at the beginning stages, and the contractors have left because they haven't been paid for half a year. Hmm. So now she's going to be in charge of the Department of Communications, right? Yay.
Mm. Well, she can't do a worse job than Faith Mutambi. Let's just pause for a minute and take, you know, cognizance of that. I mean, you couldn't possibly try to do a worse job if you had a hammer and there were only nails around you. You couldn't do a worse job.
That's true. That department has had a series of very unfortunate ministers over the years. You know, starting with back in the day with Ivy Matsepe Kasaburi, mm-hmm. whom I used to call Poison Ivy. you know, the question is, has the government ever shown itself to be capable of seizing the opportunities and managing the challenges of rapid advances in information and communication technology? Right? No, it hasn't. Not ever. Right? Back in the day when they thought people needed more connectivity, needed more phones just after the democratic transition, they decided that cell phone licenses could be issued to the private sector because they were just toys for the rich. But landlines were the thing.
Yeah.
And therefore, Telkom needs to have a monopoly and everyone needs to get a landline because, you know, too many people haven't had landlines because of apartheid.
And that went really well for Telkom and very poorly for Vodacom and Cell C and MTN.
Yeah, that went extremely well for the strategic investment. What were they called? Strategic investment partner of Telkom, right. An American company. Mm-hmm. But the number of lines declined. The number of lines in operation declined and keep declining. You know, there are fewer landlines now than there ever were because we don't need them. Right. And cell phones, right? We've got like something like 2 cell phones to every person in this country.
Right.
You know, and that's what the capitalists did with their supposed toy for the rich. The government just got that completely wrong. And it's one story after another, just like that. So saying we're going to seize the opportunities is just empty talk. If you ask the private sector why South Africa's technology sector has not performed better in the last 20 years, right, every single one will tell you tales of government monopolies, of incompetence, of policy uncertainty, and overregulation. I'll eat my hat if anyone says, oh, if only we had a digital industrial revolution commission, we'd all be rich.
Yeah, I don't hear that kind of language. Let's talk about the national minimum wage. That's another thing you brought up in the Sona. What is this obsession with paying everybody a bare minimum? It's almost as if we regard ourselves as having succeeded if we can just reach a certain threshold and ordinary talented South Africans are at least paid a bare minimum. Is that better than nothing, or is it the most patronizing talk you've ever heard?
It's very patronizing. In fact, it's often got a counterproductive effect in that people who now earn above the minimum wage end up going down to minimum wage because companies say, well, you know, we don't have to pay you anymore. This is what the government says.
Right.
Right. So it sort of reduces their ability to negotiate their own wage higher. Minimum wage is not something that just magically raises the income of the lowest paid workers in society. Mm. A wage is a price for labor. Right. Now, a price, all prices, right, with the exception of some given goods and weird things. But all prices have a downward sloping demand curve, right? Mm-hmm. That means that as the price rises, demand decreases and vice versa, right? This is how prices work. Now, there have been some revisionist papers on the topic which claim to show that miraculously higher minimum wages do not lead to lower employment. But the majority of economic research disagrees with those. And one of the reasons that is that one cannot test what employment levels would have been in the absence of a higher minimum wage. Mm. Now, so you can't count all the jobs that might have been created if wages were allowed to float lower.
So why do we hear so much noise in the mainstream media about how a minimum wage is a good thing because it guarantees people dignity in a certain occupation?
A living wage.
Well, what is that all about?
If you think simplistically, Bastiat used to say that. He wrote about the things that are seen and the things that are not seen. The things that are seen is that a poor worker, a cashier or a cleaner, now gets more money, right? Which is great. They get to buy more stuff. They get to send their kids to school. They've got some more money to pay for healthcare. Mm-hmm. Lovely. But what the unseen effects, right, is what that does for unemployment in general. Are you going to get millions of new jobs? No, you're actually going to get exactly the opposite, right? You're going to get fewer jobs. It makes it illegal for an unemployed person, right, to accept a job below the government stipulated wage rate,
right?
Even if they would prefer that low wage over unemployment, and the job would not be available at the minimum wage.
In other words, the corollary to this theory is that you are explicitly excluding some people from the economy because they don't
Correct.
Have the ability to reach that minimum wage level, and so they can't be employed at all.
Which, people who cannot add sufficient value to justify the minimum wage will remain unemployed.
And in this country, we already have an unemployment rate, which is somewhere around 27%. A lot of people are talking about how that's an insurmountable number for this government to try and erect. And of course, government can't create jobs. That's antithetical to what they exist for. Government pay out of the national treasury.
Government cannot be productive.
Right.
Government can only take other people's money to spend.
So let's
before we end on that one, without any irony, I noticed that Ramaphosa excluded domestic workers from the national minimum wage. Because why? He feared unemployment. So domestic work, for some reason, obeys the price mechanism, but all other labor doesn't.
I didn't know that. Does that mean
there's a flat-out contradiction right there?
So hang on. Is it explicitly excluded?
Yes, from the national minimum wage. They'll have their own minimum wage, which is lower than the national minimum wage.
Because so often we're told that in examples that are given, that the minimum wage applies particularly to people like domestic workers who sometimes get paid way below what they should, and they sometimes have to do horrible work, and you know they get considered as kind of servants. And
what I mean is they get a lower minimum wage than everyone else.
That seems
so.
That
you're talking about a national minimum wage. The domestics are excluded from that. They do have their own minimum wage, which is at a lower level.
That's incredible. I mean, it's almost like prejudice of a very specific kind.
Oh, no, that's because he fears unemployment in that sector.
Hmm. All right, let's talk about employment for a second, because the one thing Cyril has done is he's retained this enormous unwieldy cabinet, and he's kept a lot of people in there that we have a problem with. Are there any good reasons to applaud this cabinet and the new appointments, and even bringing back of old people? Are there any reasons in your book for us to be excited or to be hopeful or to be optimistic with Cyril Ramaphosa's cabinet ministers?
Well, there are a few reasonable appointments. You know, Nene is not a bad appointment. He's proved himself to be a fairly competent finance minister. Gordon, State and Enterprises is a it's a pretty good call. I mean, if anyone can fix them, he can probably. I mean, he's one of those very rarities, you know, an honest communist.
Yeah.
He's fundamentally a good guy. I mean, I love the way that he would go and sign Jacques Poe's book, you know, at book signings. he's honest. He's not corrupt. He's completely opposed to the whole Gupta Zuma corruption nexus. But in general, look, you've got to remember that those people do remain socialists, and that is what that's the sort of thing they implement, you know. So from that perspective, no, you can't really be all that positive. And from the corruption and incompetence perspective, a number of ministers have been axed. The people that he obviously couldn't keep on. But quite a few have been retained in Ramaphosa's cabinet. Most prominent among them is the deputy president, David Mabuza. Mm-hmm. Right, who's been implicated in both corruption and political violence. You know, I mean, the guy is a thug.
Right.
Another is the lying zuptoid Malusi Gigaba.
Yeah.
Right. We know he was captured. The capture of the state-owned institutions happened under his watch, and he lied about it under oath.
So, I mean,
court.
How much of what he spoke about at the budget last week matters if he was really a talking head whose head was going to roll the next week in respect of his finance position?
Well, I was astonished that he delivered the budget in the first place.
It really,
his delivery, incidentally, was awesome.
Yeah, it pulls the carpet out from under treasury in some ways, because there was this guy parading, and I wrote a thing about how he was a pretend finance minister, but it turned out that's exactly what he was.
Yeah, well, now Nene takes over, and he has basically has to deal with the budget that was written for him by Malusi Gigaba and the ANC.
Mm.
So he gets absolutely no freedom, and certainly not in his first year as finance minister.
So you can understand then why he was less than excited to take the job.
Yeah, indeed. I would be too.
Yeah.
You're going to put me in a job when the first thing I want to do, it's like starting as manager of a football team. First job you want is to be able to hire and fire some players so you can actually get a team together that you think can win.
Explain to me as simply as you can, and you have a way of kind of cutting to the core of an issue without having to be distracted by externalities. Explain to me why this expropriation without compensation bill is bad and how it was necessary in a country where expropriation has been an available implementation of policy by government for, 22 years? It's been something they could use and didn't very often use. Why was this necessary and what's it really about?
Well, that to me was the real bombshell of the last week or two. And I think it's appropriate that we discuss it on a show called The Burning Platform. It now appears to me that spinning off the EFF to raise this issue, only to adopt it back into the ANC's platform once the shouting was over, I think was the strategy all along. It perfectly chimes with the socialist policies of the ANC and the National Democratic Revolution, which was written by the Communist Party and remains the ANC's sort of central ideology document, where they want to hold land in the hands of the state,
mm-hmm.
right? And then government decides how best it is used. All right, so you get to lease your land,
mm-hmm.
right? And it can lead to all sorts of weird things. I mean, the government can basically decide what you can and can't do on your land. Now, they appear to want to start with farmland, and they believe that the redistribution process to date has not been successful, which is true. It hasn't, partially because a lot of the claims haven't actually been processed. And a lot of the claims that have been processed, I think I read some statistics from the Institute for Race Relations the other day that said of the claims that have been processed and farms that have been expropriated and given to new farmers, about 70-80% fail to create a marketable surplus. Right. So only 25-odd% of those farms actually continue to work. So we have a problem that they feel that there hasn't enough has happened under the regime of expropriation with compensation.
Mm.
Right. So now they're going to go with expropriation without compensation.
And how will that change things from the point of view of government?
Well, for a start, they'll have to gut the property clause, right? And that has incredibly wide implications, because once you can expropriate land without compensation, you can expropriate any property without compensation.
So that means technically that they could take your car or your pen, or they could come around and steal your chickens.
Yeah, they could take your house, they could take your car. No property is safe. They could take your investments. If they believe that you've made too much money in a company, they could take half of your windfall. They could confiscate everything. If they ran out of money, they could raid your pension fund, your private pension fund,
mm-hmm.
Because it's a national emergency. Who wouldn't want to help South Africa, remain out of the hole? So we're going to confiscate 20% of all pension funds.
But they're talking.
All of that becomes possible.
That sounds hugely alarmist to some people, because we've heard mutterings in the last couple of days of much more moderate takes on this, from even Julius Malema saying, no, we're not going to take anyone off their land or chase them away. Somehow we're magically just going to make land out of nothing. Or, worse still, I heard that, food security is a big issue to government, and they will prioritize things like food security despite having to try and enact this. What do you make of that? Is it again doublespeak?
It is doublespeak. Of course they're not going to say that. They're going to do all of this, at once, and they won't. I mean, this will be a gradual process. Malema wants all land, including industrial, commercial, and residential land, to be in the hands of government. He believes that government can somehow decide whether land is optimally used, which of course the government can't because it has no way to know that. But that's how he wants the whole.
Are you saying this because you know his mind or because you've read the EFF's manifesto?
No, that's what he actually said the other day.
Yeah,
a few days ago, he said, nobody will lose their house, or their shop or whatever, but the land will belong to the government.
So we'll all rent from the government.
We'll all lease from the government. Correct. At the government's pleasure. As soon as the government doesn't like what we're doing on that land, then they just cancel our lease. Easy enough. Now, Ramaphosa then said that we are determined that expropriation without compensation should be implemented in a way that increases agricultural production and improves food security. And that is exactly what Hugo Chavez said in Venezuela in 2010, just a few years ago. And almost immediately, food imports began to rise, and today the country is quite literally starving. Everything that has been nationalized has been destroyed, leaving behind a ruined economy and hyperinflation with the rising civilian death toll. You can say whatever you like. All your good intentions can be good. We're going to do this in such a way. But what if it can't be done in a way that improves food security? I mean, a well-connected source tells me that the government believes it only really needs the largest 20% of farms to produce food, which leaves 80% of small and medium-sized farms to be subdivided into small holdings and given to the peasants.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, this will totally destroy rural and small-town economies. I mean, half of the food I buy from small and local farms in the area, and not because I go out and I'm one of these greenies that, believes in buying local.
Well, you are a bit of an environmental activist, I must say.
yes, I am, in a manner of speaking. I go to my supermarket, and these brands are there in the supermarket, and they are cheaper.
Yeah.
Than anything else. Stuff imported from other provinces or something. So the small and medium sized farms have a huge role to play in food security, especially at a local level. So if you do this, if you destroy all of those, turn them into small holdings, it's going to entirely destroy the rural and small town economies. I just said that only about 25% of redistributed farmland continue to produce marketable surpluses. So this is going to cause a massive decline in the supply of fresh foods, which will cause sharp food price increases.
Right.
And that's how it starts.
So you're just saying that there's the realistic market, and then there's this idea that politicians have that they can adjust it and they can make it different.
Yes, that they can fiddle with things and they can expropriate large swathes of land with no consequences, or in fact the opposite of what the likely consequences will be. It's magic thinking. It's just dreams.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, you've raised a lot of things that I suppose some people are not comfortable with dealing with, and some people don't have answers for yet, and probably the president doesn't have answers for.
Before I go, I want to leave you with one more thought.
Yeah.
How do you think thousands of farmers with plenty guns and nothing left to lose are likely to respond?
Yeah, this is the threat of violence that a lot of people have mentioned.
Exactly. They could be nice and just hand over the keys. But somehow I don't think that'll happen. They'll argue that they have a basic right to defend their property by force of arms if the state won't do it for them. Now, I mean, it's the Constitution prohibits us from actually discussing whether we think that that argument is justified, because we are not allowed to advocate for war.
Mm-hmm.
But there it is. I mean, that's how they're going to think. A farmer with nothing to lose and lots of guns, how is he going to respond?
You could also argue that someone who's got nothing and has nothing to lose either in terms of their position in the economy might be willing to do things too that lead to violence.
True. So I can see bloodshed happening on both sides of that particular equation.
If it's not managed extremely carefully by people who are very sensitive to issues on both sides.
Yeah, indeed.
All right. Well, Ivo, it's
and I fear it won't be.
It's always good to catch up, and thank you for standing in this morning. We'll continue to see what you're up to in the various publications you write for, and appreciate you being part of the Burning Platform today.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Ivo Fechter. And the Burning Platform brought to you by Nando's. It is just after 7:30. I'm thrilled that Liz Ogumbo's here, that Toby Shapshak is here. We're going to talk in a moment or two. I want to find out all about the Stuff Awards, which are taking place. How are you, Toby?
Very good. How are you?
Excellent. Very, very good. Just want to throw in one or two comments here about Ben, because people have been messaging about Ben and his grumpiness.
That is so devilishly good looking.
Yeah, well, Toby, it doesn't get mentioned a lot, but thank you.
Mabale, listen to this. I'm with Ben on that Beyonce and Chris Martin song. They're definitely in it for the money and selling young girls exaggerated dreams.
Yep.
Ben is the master pessimist, says someone else.
Debatable.
Someone asked about whether Daniela's back, because Ben sounds like he needs attention.
No, very well loved.
All right. The only song I can listen to that features or includes Beyonce, it's great. I hate her music, but that song is great. So some people agreeing with me. And then somebody says, Ramaphosa and his cadres have said that they have a plan, and the plan is the National Development Plan. How many people even know what that is? I'm pretty sure the NDP doesn't have the phrase expropriation without compensation anywhere in it. They're just being populist. And hey, guys, what happened to Lindiwe Zulu? Yeah, nobody's talking about her. Is she still there? Is she still doing something? Do we know, Mubs? Do we know what her position in cabinet is?
She's one of the oldest members, isn't she?
I don't know. I mean, Lindiwe Zulu she was the Minister of Small Business and SMMEs, they called her. But I don't know what she's up to now. When we come back in a second, we'll catch up with Toby Shapshak, find out about the Stuff Awards. Liz is here to talk about her music career and interesting things that are going on there. And we're going to talk to you. You can get hold of us on WhatsApp, 079-748-2090. If you want to call us on the phone, you can do that too. It's very, very easy to do. All you need to do is pick up the phone, 0861-555-189. Robbie Williams, Advertising Space. Let's talk about a couple of things this morning. It's Friday, so a lot of people are in a good mood. The weekend's coming up. In just a few days, the Stuff Awards, which is probably South Africa's premium expose of the best gadgets, the best ideas, the best in tech of the year. They'll take place. And Toby Shapshak, you've kind of you've taken a bit of a back seat when it comes to judging these awards, but you still host them.
No, I still do participate in the judging.
You actually do?
Craig is the editor.
But you don't, do you have a say, or do you just
Yes.
You're a very powerful man.
Well, I like to feel like I'm an empowering man, you know.
Well, you are.
I have demoted myself to the publisher, so Craig has stepped up as the editor.
Listen,
you know, you've got to mention the apps, because I think that the kind of the big growth area in the world is apps. You know, I mean, if you think about rags to riches stories, you had to be a boxer to break out of the.
I was humble bragging because we won App of the Year once, and yes. I was, and that's by the
in
way.
In fact, you were. Well, I think you were our inaugural app winner.
I'm so proud of that. It's in our studio, and it stays there all the time for everyone to see. The Stuff Awards we'll talk about in a second. Liz Ogumbo is both of you have actually hosted a show at various times on Cliff Central. You did for a short stint when we just started, Toby. Liz has been here almost from the very beginning. Fashion Lab is her baby, but she's got plenty of other things that she's good at and that she's doing. Most especially, we are here to talk this morning about her music career. And plenty of other things, but I've got a present for both of you. So, Toby, here's our, I think this is only the fourth or fifth pair we've handed out.
Woo-hoo!
And Liz, you're also right in the front of the queue here. So,
thank you.
What a pleasure. This is our cliffcentral.com wireless earphones. They've been specially made for podcast listening, and they're wireless so that you don't have to attach your phone to them. Because, Toby, as you know, they've made these jacks so complicated now that if you have an Apple phone, you can't use certain earphones. If you have a Samsung, you can't use others.
Really?
You have those AirPods that fall out of your ear the whole time. although I can't say I've experienced them, so I just don't want to buy them. And then with all these different things going on, people have different reasons to have different earphones. So you could have three or four different pairs that you like. And knowing Liz, she probably has a pair in different colors to match each of her outfits.
Well, Gareth, you know what? I'm music, and you know, and we listen a lot, so I actually like the big phones. I mean, headphones. So I can
because
I need the whole surround with me as we go. So I'm interested to see how these, as small as they look, how they actually.
Give them a try. Tell me what you think.
Thank you.
A little present. So
I also have before we even go on, I also have some gifts for you there. I've got my new album called Kental the Lotus Chapter. I've got the two singles. There's Monom and there's What You Know About Her.
First of all, the cover of this album is beautiful. It's because it's you on it, which is a good start. Liz is, you've actually been an artist as long as you've been a model. In terms of your music?
No, I actually commercially started my music in 2010. So that was my first album, was actually 2010.
And you were 16 when you started.
Right. Do you want us to go there, Gareth?
No, I just know that you've been all over the world. You've been in New York and Milan and Paris and Kenya.
The modeling was, that's 20 years back. The music is, I think I could still consider myself a new musician. I don't know what new means anyway, but look, the music is there. It's beautiful music.
The music's new.
Old or new.
And it's fresh. Toby, let's talk first about the Stuff Awards, because they're happening in 2 weeks' time.
Indeed.
What other categories? You mentioned app. We've got the phone. We've got the laptop.
Yes, so what we do is we look at all of the great technology that happens through the year, and a lot of them are the products at the back of the magazine, the top tens, the laptop of the year, the cell phone of the year, the camera of the year, the game of the year, the Bluetooth speaker of the year. It's fascinating to me how things have shifted in the last 10 years. You know, the primary device we all used to use in the knowledge economy, let's call it, was the laptop. Now it's the smartphone.
Yeah.
You know, your smartphone is your key to the world. It's the most powerful device that you have. You know, the analogy you always hear is that the very first iPhone launched in 2007, was more powerful than the computer that landed humanity on the moon and had a better connection and a camera, as it happens, and music. So that's the world we live in. So we kind of try and reflect all of the products through the year, what they do, how they help us. We look at apps, we look at televisions, we look at audio devices, we look at cars. Tesla is again the winner of the car this year. You know, the Tesla Model X. I really, really wish we could buy them in South Africa. I feel profoundly like my next car should be an electric car. Don't you? I
mean, yeah, it just seems makes sense.
The obvious way to go. You know, there was recently, this week, in fact, the EU's looking at banning some diesel cars in some countries.
The Germans in particular, they say that they're going to stop selling diesel cars in the whole of Germany, and if you drive one, you'll have to pay extra fees.
Indeed, and it's an evolution. We're seeing an evolution of all forms of technology, and that's what we try and reflect, because it's kind of like our fashion awards, you know.
Well, that's it, and there's a huge collaborative sort of space between fashion and technology. In fact, you could argue that brands like Apple have only done as well as they have because they've managed to capitalize on that space between function and form.
Indeed.
And fulfill both as much as they could.
Yeah.
If something is beautiful, Liz, it just appeals to us a whole lot more than if something is just functional.
True.
And there is that place where even someone like you, who is profoundly interested in the artistic and creative and beautiful side of things, where you want something that works.
Yes, of course.
Well, you know, my oldest friend is in fashion, and she used to be a fashion designer, and she's helped run Fashion Week, South African Fashion Week, for the last 10 or 15 years, however long.
And then we know her name.
Yes, Savannah Erasmus.
Right.
And the fascinating thing is she got a replacement computer once, and she phoned me and she said, "This guy's arrived, and the laptop doesn't have a built-in Stiffy drive. It's got an external Stiffy drive. Can I replace it? Can I take it?"
This is a long time ago.
This was an insurance replacement, and I said yes. It is now acceptable. I still actually have that external Stiffy drive, just as a, you know, God forbid one day you need to use it. And then she tells me the story later. The guy's very relieved. He's like, "Okay, will you sign for the laptop now?" And she went, "No, take it out of the box. I want to see it." And he said, "Why?" She said, "Because if it's ugly, I'm not taking it."
Hey, everybody wants pretty things.
Exactly. And to Apple, we are grateful for that. I mean, I look around, there's a MacBook Air in front of you, Ben's on a MacBook Pro. I mean, the essence of design, I mean, I think the word we need to look at is design. Design has changed so much of the world. The functionality, of course, it looks good and it's beautiful, but it's designed to be more useful and optimal. I mean, if you think about what the iPhone did for our interface with smartphones, the fact that there's just one button, you know, now the iPhone is dispensed with the button. It's, you know, it's changed the way we interact with things. And until Steve Jobs came along, and he was a bit of a design Nazi. And he was, you know, fanatical about it, but look at what a change it's done for the way we interface with our technology. I mean, a 1 year old can pick up an iPhone and off they go and they understand it because it has a much more useful interface than a keyboard or a keypad.
Liz, are you interested in talking about technology and fashion? Are you interested in these wearables?
I think for me, technology, like I always say, we're living in a digital world and I love technology. I mean, and I don't mind trying to get and, you know, keep up with it and trying to figure it out. But once I figure it out, I think it's the way to be. So I think for me, when I look at my brand, for example, I want to be able to have everything Liz Ogumbo digitally. And I want the technology side of it or side of me to come out, because what are we going to do next? I mean, something's got to happen next. And I think of a character called Liz, so that even if you don't see me and, you know, you can hear from me and you can see me in a different light. I want to be like, I wish I could become like something that just becomes a gadget, you know.
And you want artificial intelligence.
Yeah, because where are we going? I mean, what's the next high?
Well, you got the guy here.
Well, I mean, someone would call that a clone or an automaton. I'm reading William Gibson's book, The Peripheral, at the moment. He was the science fiction writer who came up with the phrase cyberspace, and he's really considered the grandfather of this current generation of sci-fi writers. Just an extraordinary brain. I mean, his depiction of cyberspace and what it would become has come so true, and the essence of it. And in this movie, in this book, The Peripheral, which will certainly become a movie, people can put their consciousness into a peripheral, which is like a human being or a human body, like a kind of
a clone.
A clone, you know. There was that Bruce Willis movie where everyone walked around as a clone. And it's fascinating because, I don't know, 10, 15 years, we're not that far away from, you know, some kind of device like that.
Technically, that means we could live forever.
Indeed.
I mean, if you can download or upload your consciousness into any meat vehicle, you could live forever. You could change the way you look. You could change your age.
Indeed.
You could essentially stay around as long as you want to. There's no expiry date.
Here's the thing. Would you do that?
I would. Without even a moment's hesitation.
I think I would too. I mean, what is the next thing for us?
Well, it's to develop.
I would love to have people say, I'm going to buy whatever the gadget will be called, Alizify, whatever the thing will be called. Because in that thing, you can speak to Liz, you can listen to her music, you can laugh with her, you can look at her, you can see her fashion, it's something that does something. The way that the phone has a function.
But this is why I'm asking you. I mean, look at how music has changed over the last 15 years. We used to buy an article. You know, you'd buy a CD and it would be something physical you'd have to purchase. And now, probably 95% of any of the commercial activity around music happens online and happens on a device like a smartphone.
True.
So it's already happening, Liz. If we want to hear what you have to say about the business of fashion, we can listen to your Fashion Lab show. If we want to listen to your songs, we can get it on our smartphone. Mm-hmm. If we want to see what you're up to in terms of your designs and your dresses and what a collection you've got. That stuff is all available online. Mm-hmm. It has to be, right?
True.
And Toby, if you're not on there anymore, these bricks and mortar places that rely on foot traffic and shopping malls, I mean, they know they're on borrowed time, right?
Well, they do actually. And we've wandered the shopping malls of America together. Well, only one.
You're quite a shopper.
Yes. I you know, I grew up with three Jewish
sisters. Another thing Toby and Liz have in common. You're quite a shopper.
Yes, I understand how to do this. Also, I'm Jewish. You know, I know how to get a good price in America. Everything's in a good price. But the fascinating thing, and I'm just curious about the changes of culture. So there was a, for a long time, and of course it grew out of America, which was such a dominant form of they call it cultural imperialism. So much of what happened in America became what happened in the rest of the world because they were the dominant culture for the second half of the 20th century.
Right.
In the next decade, we will all look to China, which is becoming increasingly the economic dominant force. All of the major technology stuff that's going to come out of the world is going to come out of China. They're researching to artificial intelligence, quantum computing, all of this stuff. They're slowly starting out. They're out of the blocks and soon they'll be winning the race. So American culture has influenced so much of our culture. And if you think about the mall is this idea, this kind of it replaced the town square. The town square for the longest time, or the village market, was where we all congregated. You know, I've seen Highlander. I know that's where people went shopping. And now we went to the shopping mall. And yet the mall itself is dying for a number of reasons. One, there were too many malls and not enough people in the shops. Secondly, e-commerce has changed the way we do just about everything. We don't see it quite as much in South Africa, but we're starting to take a lot as an extraordinarily good business. And as very much, you know, especially have a child, believe me, your nappies are 150 rand cheaper on Takealot.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
And they deliver.
And
you have to schlep to the shops to go and pick up a packet of nappies.
It's fantastic, you know. So we've seen that, but what you've got is a consequence of all these kind of dead malls in America. And as an internet meme, they've grown, all these sites that kind of look at dead malls and the trees growing in them and what's happened to them. It's a very fascinating insight into how, this former way of doing things has died, and what it's become is something else. So shopping, yes. I mean, there's certain things that people are always going to buy. Retail. There's certain things that people are always going to go into a store.
Maybe this is
try on a pair of shoes,
right?
To check that they've.
I mean, I've seen you do this. Right?
Yes, I wore them just because it was you.
You're wearing them today. He's wearing his very fine. No, those are impressive shoes. They're like sneakers, but they look like leather. Look at those, Liz. Give us
they're
an appraisal.
Cool. I think they're cool. I think it's very cool.
What do you call them?
I don't know.
They're like a mix between a real
sneaker and a dress shoe.
Well, yeah. I call them Cole Haans.
That's what they are. That's the brand name. But it is still important with certain things to get a feel for it, right?
Yes,
I mean,
true.
You're not going to buy the kinds of outfits that you, first of all, you don't buy shop stuff. You don't go in and get off the
pegs. I do because I'm a girl. I like girl things. And I, as much as I can create everything I want to wear, because I do, I still need to get that high. So when I go to the UK, I have to do a Bicester Village stop. I have to do the high street. When I go to New York, I have to, just to be there and to buy. That's just, it doesn't mean I don't have it. But I want to just add on to what Toby was saying. You know, when you think about consumerism and you think about the digital world today, obviously in Africa, when you look at, the way that people consume, consumers are still excited to go to the mall. And that's actually an outing. I mean, in the whole continent, if you really think about how people shop, that is how people shop. And that is why, even here in South Africa, as much as yes, the brick and mortar, is dying, I've seen and I have, because of the show and because of interacting with different stakeholders in the game, you realize that the clever way to do it is to actually make sure that you still have your brick and mortar if you're in the continent,
mm-hmm.
but you have your online, you've obviously elevated it to making sure that your online presence is on fire, and not just online presence, because look at the virtual experiences that Amazon and a couple of other big giants create, because people want to literally now walk into an experience online.
Like virtual reality stuff.
It's not just hit and count the things and get the things and put them in the shopping cart and go. You want to actually have an experience on there. So I think it's interesting to see how we're going to go this year. And I know for sure that the US, definitely is on a different level. The malls are empty, but let's see how it goes.
Well, but interestingly, the malls that are flourishing in America are malls that kind of look like a high street, kind of look like Melville with the roads blocked off, streets, people wandering around, kind of like that mall we went to, right? The one in Austin, Austin, Texas. That's the kind of mood, like back to the high street. You know, I don't like going into shopping malls because on the weekends, the last thing I want to do is walk into a closed environment. And that noise, the kind of, the way the noise like bounces off the ceiling. I mean, it can drive you mad. In the '80s, they used to do these studies. It was very interesting because suddenly it was a phenomenon that no one had encountered before. And these children would go crazy inside a shopping mall, and they worked out that it was all of this white noise, that children just don't have the kind of cultural experience yet, the life experience to handle all of this oral input.
Yeah. You know, well, it is. Like, Ben hates going to shopping malls for the same reason. I've been in a shopping mall with him.
Well, with fashion sense like that, no wonder.
He loses his mind.
Yeah.
We all hate the malls. I hate the malls.
Listen.
So the fascinating thing is just how, in a way, we're kind of going back to what worked before, which is this open-air high street idea.
This is where I wanted us to go, because Africa can lead in some ways. And you know, there's this change, this sea change in kind of the way people feel about our art, our culture, our fashion, and our contribution to the way that people behave, even consumerism. Liz quite rightly mentions that we've still got, and they're not mutually exclusive. We've still got the people who like to do things the old ways, and we've got people who are doing things the new way. And sometimes the new way is actually the way that was there before the old way was established. And that's kind of, it's sort of reassuring. Mm. Because a lot of the time we're always worried in Africa that we need to catch up. In some ways, like you've often spoken about, and you did it in TED, yes, you spoke about how we led the smartphone.
Well, we do
movement.
in many ways we still do. I mean, we lead in mobile payments. The GSMA says half of all the mobile payment systems in the world are in Africa at the moment.
Oh wow!
Drone deliveries in Africa are very real. You know, in the developed world, in America, people are looking how to deliver a pizza via drone. In Rwanda, we are delivering blood to keep people alive in hospitals. It's, you know, we are doing things that everyone else says is still not possible, and yet we're doing them. But I, you know, as much as it pains me to agree with Ivor Vechter, we are looking for kind
of... Make it clear you don't normally.
Very seldomly. We are looking for local experiences, you know, and experience is the big word. You know, 4 years ago, I spoke at a big marketing conference in London, run by an agency called Contagious. They're a very big advertising marketing agency. And 4 years ago, that's what everybody was speaking about, that it's all about the experience. Retail is becoming the experience. You don't want to walk into a store. If you go into the Nike store in Sandton or Rosebank, there's a treadmill. They said you want to try on a pair of shoes and some running clothes. Like, you don't want to just look at the shoes. You want to experience the shoes. You want to have an experience. And if you see this, you know, you travel a lot, Gareth. You see this internationally a lot more and more and more. It's not just walking into basically a physical catalog. You walk in and you have to have an experience of the brand. You have to see something. You know, you go to an espresso store, you buy your, you know, overpriced. I mean, it's kind of like the designer drug of the tweens.
These pods,
you know.
Yeah, these pods, you know, are like, it's like a drug dealer.
Yeah, I mean, I used to think the designer drug.
It looks like a pharmacy.
Yeah, the designer drug of the 90s was sushi. The designer drug of the noughts was AVIs. And the designer drug of the tweens is, you know, I don't know yet. Maybe it's an espresso, but you go in and they give you an espresso and you taste it and you experience it and you have
the
experience.
The experience.
No, it's all very Jimi Hendrix.
But it's true. I mean, this has been turned into ad speak, but it actually is what people really are interested in. Now, you took a call in Toby's shoes there. You seem to approve of them. What phone are you using? Let Toby comment on how sophisticated you are.
I am on the S8 Plus, but I am a Samsung girl, so I'm sorry again. I think the S8 Plus is
what do you
fresh.
Think of her it's, choice,
it's,
Toby?
It's a very good choice, but I'm not a phone fashion snob, you know. I'm like, you know, there was a long time where I used the very small Sony Ericsson W800. Do you remember that?
I remember that.
It used to fit in the the coin pocket of my jeans.
I used to use that old Nokia 8800 or whatever.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
It was cute,
yeah.
And it was a fashion statement.
It was. Yeah. Yeah. It was really great. Have you seen Nokia's just relaunched the 8810, which is the phone that Keanu Reeves got out of the Matrix with? Do you remember that? The banana bold phone. No, it slid up and down. So you
popped it. Yeah, that one.
Down.
I remember that. That was the one I had.
Yeah. It's a really, really great little device.
Now, you two are expert in your various fields. I did get Liz in here for a particular reason this morning to talk about her music. Tell us about the album, Liz, because I know Toby also has music in his Stuff magazine. So who knows, you might end up in the Stuff Awards at some point. Tell us about the album, Cancel.
So Cancel, the first album was called Cancel. This is now Cancel, the Lotus Chapter. Mm-hmm. So the first thing is, obviously, I've dubbed my sound as Cancel because my sound has such a melange of different influences. You know, from your reggae to chakacha, from the Swahili to Luo music to hip hop to blues and swing to so many things that you can't, I would lie if I had to call it one. Yeah. So that's the reason I've dubbed my sound Cancel. The Lotus Chapter is, just a representation of my evolution. You know, you think about my first album, you think about all this time, and then you think about the second album, which is this one. And, like a lotus that emerges from a pond, and then blooms. So within 3 days, blooms from mid-morning till about mid-afternoon. That is exactly how I feel. So I have emerged like a lotus. That is why we call it the Lotus Chapter. So much has happened. I've evolved in so many ways. My sound has evolved as well in so many ways. And I just think whoever's interested in experiencing Cancel, the Lotus Chapter, will be pleasantly surprised.
All right, so you've had your launch.
We have not had a launch. We've had a listening experience two nights ago.
All right.
So we had a listening experience where I wanted to just tantalize and...
And you did a live performance?
And yes. I wanted to take the experience. I don't know why people still pop a CD in and say it's a listening experience. I mean, we might as well go play it in the car or play it at home. So I wanted to give people a live experience of everything and just share with them what the stories are about and why, you know. Cancel is not just my Kenyan soul when it comes to my music. Cancel goes beyond music. So obviously it's the food, it's everything that Liz offers to you. My Kenyan soul is Cancel. So the experience was able to embody that. We went live. I think it was beautiful.
I'm sure it was. Nothing you've ever done, is it?
We go, all right. We go home.
I'm going to bring in George Meany quickly. George is, of course, the CEO of Auto Trader. He's one of the hosts of hashtag Auto Central. And he's here this morning, as he is every Friday, just to give us a couple of stories. And I'm very happy that we've got Liz and Toby here because, again, people are very picky about the kind of – Toby was talking about electric cars earlier, George. We talk about this overlap between – what looks good and what works well, form and function. This is something you care about too.
Absolutely care about, Gareth, and good morning, Liz.
Good morning.
My perspective on technology, and particularly technology in cars, I think Tesla's got it right. Technology should fade into the background if it works properly.
You agree?
I totally agree. I totally agree. And also, I think the fascinating thing about Tesla is because Elon Musk didn't have any legacy to protect, he has just gone like blue sky. Like, why should we have a dashboard? There's no reason to have a dashboard.
Exactly.
Why don't we have a tablet? You know, there's a big iPad in the middle of the dashboard.
Car, yeah.
Brilliant. You know, I love that.
Now, when Toby and I were in America last year, George and Liz, and everybody else. So we saw the Tesla showroom in Austin. They only have a few around America because they're aiming for a very particular market and they want to eventually go mainstream, and I think they will.
Yeah.
But at this point they have to sell to the people who are going to make the trend.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You've seen this car.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary. We were talking about it last week and we talked about how he launched in the Falcon X one of these Teslas into space.
Isn't that just the just best marketing
such a statement
thing
ever. But what a statement about how you can be Tony Stark.
Oh, yeah. That's absolutely right. I mean, the fact that his comment was, you know, usually rockets put concrete into the rocket to test the weight of whatever the rocket's going to carry. And his comment was, that's so boring. Let's put a car inside this bloody rocket.
I mean, it has given us.
You like that, Liz?
I like that.
It has given us arguably the most iconic image of space and Earth since that famous blue dot. you know, that it was taken in 1994 from the, you know, from the moon of that, you know, the planet Earth. I mean, so I think it's just fantastic, you know.
Well,
who doesn't want a roadster now, you know?
While exactly. While I've got Liz and Toby here, let's go through some of the stories that you picked up this week that you're interested in.
Yeah, so from a motorsport point of view, the biggest change to Formula One this year is going to be the halo on the Formula One cars.
Ben, you spoke Formula One
yesterday.
Hello, Ben.
I didn't see you hiding behind your laptop.
Bring everybody in on this. Yeah.
Yeah, so the halo is the biggest change to Formula One this year, and Toto Wolff, who is the team principal of Mercedes, has come out and slammed the thing. Said he would take a chainsaw to the halo if he could. The first Formula One team boss that's actually spoken out heavily against this halo. So
it's dissension in the ranks.
Yeah,
I don't want to, you know, admit my ignorance on, you know, on radio, but
you're allowed to be.
What is it?
It is
dullest sport in the world, motor racing. I mean, I usually reserve that for soccer and cricket, but I mean, really.
All right, so explain to him what the halo is, and maybe we can all get involved.
So these cars do incredible speeds, and it comes from Ayrton Senna's death,
yes,
where he plowed into a wall, and the one tire, because his steering column broke, the one tire hit him in the head.
Yes.
And kill them.
Yes.
Because of the open cockpits, they've now put this halo around the top of the cockpit.
Yes.
That could effectively hold a bus and to deflect big debris.
You would want one, Toby, if you were driving a super fast car. Don't pretend.
No. I here we go. Look, like, I'm not a sporty person, right? But the only sporty thing I can do is drive fast. And I like to think I'm a very good driver, no matter what my wife says.
So this halo, it could be the thing you need to be
to
able
survive.
To drive.
Survive.
Yeah.
Survive if you have an accident in a Formula One car doing 270 kilometers an hour. Amazingly enough, you could be hit in the head by a tire.
Yeah. Right.
Exactly.
There are
exactly.
Enough,
so that's what that's what the halo looks like.
All right, but this guy doesn't like it from a second.
He doesn't like it. He says it's aesthetically unappealing. So
yeah, God forbid you look bad as you crash at 240,000
well, gazillion
miles
ago.
An hour.
Exactly.
I suspect Liz would say the same thing. She'd be like, why
look,
is that thing
as long
in
as
way?
It's pretty, as long as it's pretty, it's fine. We want to survive. Whoever's doing that wants
well,
to survive.
Let's not go down the road of aesthetically pleasing with Formula One, because they've removed all the pit lane girls too.
Yes, and that's because that's very sexist.
Yeah, they put children in instead.
Yeah,
I mean,
worse.
You can't talk about Formula One and aesthetics, right? Like there's Ben scrolling through pictures on his laptop next to me. I mean, there is no space for the actual color of the car underneath all the branding. You know that I mean, it's fascinating. They sell every inch of the car to a sponsor. They even sell the jumpsuits, those fire retardant suits.
Well, Toby, they're doing something
right. They sell the little strip under the arm so that when the guy holds up the trophy,
you can
see Red Bull under his armpit.
George, you should get Toby back for an actual Auto Central show.
He's coming on Auto Central. That's no
you've got to get him
out.
You know, I
because you guys review cars as well.
Yes. But here's the thing, right? So, like, most, you know, I have this conversation with people about cell phones. People buy cell phones based on how many megapixels the camera has. Why?
True.
Because
that's
nobody
true.
Understands.
Does.
Nobody understands what a processor does or how much RAM it is. I mean, there's a certain amount of people who do, and that's great. And I understand what it means, and I know why it's better. And you know, the quality of the touchscreen gives you a better. No one in general cares about that.
No.
In the same way that, like, I don't care that Cole Haan used to be owned by Nike and therefore has this amazing sole technology and therefore the soles are very
just like the feel of the shoes.
I just want comfortable shoes, right? So most people, what do most people buy their car on? I have this conversation with car people often, and whenever I write about cars, I proudly proclaim
it is an emotional purchase.
Exactly.
And it's purchased purely on the way it looks, and that's why the halo is unpopular.
Wow.
But I mean, the Formula One car, let's be honest, is not a very good looking car.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Have you been in one?
You kind of need to get out. I haven't been in a Formula One. I think
exactly.
I've been in a Formula something or other. They had one at Kyle Army. I sat in one once. It is really something. I mean,
it's designed to go fast.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
What it's designed.
Exactly. It's beautiful for what it does.
Yes.
That's exactly what it is.
All right. Tell me what else is in the news.
Sorry, well, sorry, George, just one more thing.
Sorry, Ben.
Ayrton Senna died in 1994. We get a Halo in 2018.
It's a long ironic gap.
It's a big gap.
Have they just forgotten about it and they're picking it up again?
No, they made a movie recently, right?
Because the movie came out.
Yeah.
No, what they have done is they've done a lot of other things. The driver now sits deeper in the car. There's protection around the driver's head and shoulders. So they have done a lot of things.
Between Ayrton Senna and now, they didn't like the drivers and they thought, well, if something happens, so what?
Yeah, I don't want to be all rational here, but like, let's look at physics. Okay, so physics is what really makes these cars go very fast. They're streamlined, they're aerodynamic, the foil, the fin at the back pushes the car flatter on the ground. Okay, so if you want to protect the person inside, why don't you put like a dome, like a cockpit, a fighter pilot?
You don't see fighter pilots flying around
without their heads on.
Everybody is against a closed cockpit because then we might as well be doing normal Group N racing. Formula One is known for its open cockpit car. And that's one of the things that makes it different to other motorsports is it's an open cockpit car.
I'm just looking at this from a visibility kind of thing. You've suddenly got this
thing in front of you.
Sort of like, it looks like the top of a G-string, to be completely frank from the driver's perspective.
It does look like a bit of an upside down
G-string. Liz, do you agree?
It really does. I mean, you look at that as a driver. Yeah. It's like you're looking at something.
I love the way you always bring such intelligence.
But anyway.
That's what I'm here for officially. What else?
The Honda Acura NSX has been spotted in South Africa. Now,
let me look that up.
So Honda, last year, Honda South Africa, said that the Acura, which is the next supercar, is not going to come to South Africa. But it's been spotted in South Africa and in Johannesburg particularly. Beautiful car. I think it's going to do some damage to the Audi R8, but cost 6 million rand.
Wow. Okay. So I'm not going to get
it. It is a sports hybrid all-wheel drive 573 horsepower power unit that drives all four wheels.
Don't you love the fact that, forget about Ayrton Senna dying 30 years ago, we're still talking about cars in terms of horsepower.
Well, it's the most obvious way for some people to understand
it's
it.
It's the megapixel of cars. Really.
Exactly. And then big news this week was Geely bought a stake in Daimler. I'm sure
you
heard
about that.
Who are Geely? Geely is a car manufacturer from China.
Okay. And they've now got a stake in what?
In Mercedes. Daimler. Well, Daimler owns Mercedes. Right. They've got a stake in Daimler. 9%,
to be honest. Is this like the Tata owns Jaguar?
Yes. Okay. Well, believe it or not, Geely owns Volvo, owns Lotus.
Right.
And now owns a stake in Daimler. So who knows? Maybe
eventually all our cars will be owned by the Chinese and Indians, which is exactly what Toby was saying about how the world economy is changing.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't surprise me. You know, they're interesting shifts in the history. You know, the biggest shift of the First World War and the Second World War is that the financial power shifted from England to America, and the collapse of the economic crisis of 2008 saw a lot of that economic power shift to Asia. It's a totally different conversation, but obviously, you know, more cars are sold in China every year than the whole world put together.
More Toyotas are sold in the world than any other car. Toyota almost.
My first car was a Toyota.
Toyota's massive. So watch the East.
Toyota. Toyota. I drive a Toyota. Yeah.
Akira.
There's
a study being launched in South Africa because everybody thinks EVs, the electric vehicles, are going to come to Africa maybe in a decade or two, but the transport ministry has launched a study to find out what the impact of electric vehicles to the economy and to South Africa
is
going to be
out in about 10 years time
in the next couple of years, which I think is interesting. My worry is, are they doing it because of the fuel tax?
Well, more importantly, George, I mean, we've now got a new transport minister in Bladen Zimande. We know what a great job he did in higher education.
Yeah, we definitely want a communist driving the economy and nurturing.
So I don't know. What's the answer? Do you have any ideas?
No. It's just been launched. They want to figure out what impact it has on the trade balance, employment, and particularly the liquid fuel sector, which carries all of the fuel tax.
Ha. Ha, that's why they're worried about it. Let's get to the nuts and bolts. The real reason government care about electric vehicles and they'll try to keep them out as long as possible because they can't get tax money out of them the way that they do out of fuel.
Well, this is a debate going on with cryptocurrency. All of a sudden, everyone's going, hang on, we're like missing out here. Not only do we not regulate it.
We can't tax it.
We can't tax it. And you know, we need a source of income from it. So, I mean, that's the biggest problem with new disruptive technologies, be it Uber or Airbnb or cryptocurrency or electric vehicles.
It's hard to tax.
The government doesn't know how to get their pound of flesh.
But Liz, George, Toby, if there's one thing you can definitely know about the world, it's that if something is a scary thing to governments, it's probably good for us.
It's a good point.
True.
Where something is difficult to control, it's mm-hmm. good for the consumer.
Right. Damn yes. right. Open it up.
I agree. And then finally, Jeremy Clarkson is being considered to be the host of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? They want to revive the show. I thought this was quite interesting because Top Gear was a massive success. I'm not sure the Grand Tour is that much of a success. So will he be successful at Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
What do you think?
Isn't it broadcast by the BBC?
Don't know. That would be unlikely because they don't like
ITV.
I think it's ITV.
George, would you like Clarkson to be on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire or do you not care?
I don't care.
I mean, it's interesting because Top Gear was a phenomenon in its own way. I mean, everybody, men, women, non-believers, non-car drivers, it was entertainment that just happened to feature cars.
Well, I think that's what Clarkson brings because, you know, he's coined phrases like the only person to ever look good in the back of a four-seat convertible is Adolf Hitler. and things like speed doesn't kill anyone, suddenly becoming stationary is what gets you.
Yeah.
So I think that's what they're trying to bring to the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
I mean, I think he always wrote the best car review. So you write an 800-word car review, spend 600 words complaining about whatever pissed him off that week, and then 200 words going, it's got four wheels and it's red, which is how I write car reviews. It's fast.
Exactly.
It's red.
Hey, who's in the Stuff Awards
for
the car of the year? Let's have
Tesla Model X.
That's the winner.
Yeah. Let's invite George.
Hmm.
Yeah.
George,
I can't get Elon Musk out to receive
George
the award.
Is a really good second place for Elon Musk.
I mean,
I'm impressed. That's that's the compliment of the century.
Anyway, I mean, the Grand Tour just wasn't the same.
No.
Same people, same incredibly high production values, massive budget.
I watched the first season. I liked it.
Did you?
I thought it was good, but it just never took off.
We watched I don't know how many episodes and just went, meh. Mm. You know, it wasn't like season two of
I think
the
it's
Crown,
because you
it?
Had to go and seek it out, whereas the BBC kind
I
of...
I think that's a problem, and that's how Netflix exists.
Yeah.
I reckon it's got to do with the fact that in the time where Top Gear was the only game in town... There wasn't any other good television, full stop.
Yeah. Top Gear was such a great show. Because of the choice?
That's a factor, but actually, I think it's something more. You know, the great thing about Clarkson is that he didn't give a shit. Yeah. You know, look at what that's done for Anthony Bourdain. You know, we listened to him at South by Southwest, and he said, not giving a fuck has been a really great career choice for me, you know, or career strategy. No, that you know Anthony Bourdain.
I'm saying Clarkson.
So, but the problem with Clarkson is that it all went to his head.
Mm.
So as soon as you believe your own PR, there's a lack of authenticity. You see it with people when they become famous or they become big stars or, you know, they start talking about themselves in the third person and you see the way people just become inauthentic. Why? Because they believe their own PR. Fake. They think they're something wonderful. And as soon as that happens, something in us registers that and goes
fake.
I mean, what did you do? Did you cure cancer? Why did you deserve such a big ego?
But also with Top Gear, it was a car show that just happened to be hugely entertaining as a bonus, whereas now the Grand Tour is, they go, okay, you guys must be funny like you were on Top Gear, because now it's being pitched as an entertainment show, and cars happen, so it's almost like it spins around.
Yeah.
So we were getting more than we initially thought, and that's why we loved it.
Look, I mean, it's not to say Top Gear wasn't contrived. I mean, they had three different personalities.
Well, they had Richard Hammond for a start. He's the most contrived human on earth.
And let's not also forget that this was a very scripted show. It was very carefully produced and put together. There was a lot of of behind the scenes stuff that went on that wasn't reliant on Clarkson and May and Hammond, but it was a tremendous success. Also, a creature of its time. I mean, sometimes the idea, it had how many seasons? 20 something seasons.
I mean, what who would we put in a South African version of like Top Gear? Fikile Mbalula.
Well, believe it or not, the original version of Top Gear premiered in 1977.
Wow.
And later on, Clarkson only joined in 1988.
Wow!
So it's a long,
very successful Johnny Come Lately show.
Who was the first presenter? Alan Partridge.
Don't know.
All right, George. So we're looking forward to another episode of Auto Central, which we'll. In fact, we've got a repeat of last week's episode because we do it bi-weekly, and then we'll start another one soon. You can download that from cliffcentral.com. It's available right now, and you don't want to miss any of the stuff that these guys talk about, because if you loved this discussion, you'll love that discussion just as much, if not more. Toby, thank you very much. Good luck with the Stuff Awards.
Why, thank you.
And make sure that we've got a couple of exciting new things. I'm going to put all the pressure on you for development of future technology. I've heard about this AI and this virtual reality for years.
I think it's the great leap forward. The internet's going to be big, hey?
It's going to be big.
It's going to be big.
Toby, who's winning the best golf device of the year?
Oh, golf.
GPS.
I'm a non-golfer. It's the dullest thing after motorsport.
And Liz, congratulations.
Is there anything on your list? Sorry, Gareth.
Congratulations,
Rugby
Liz.
Rugby is interesting.
On an amazing album, and I hope that you have more and more success with your music career, your fashion career. I hope your dresses continue to do wonderful things all over the world.
Thank you.
And they already have, so there's so much that's still waiting to come out of you in terms of the creativity. I still think you would look the best out of all of us in a convertible car.
I think so too. Hey, let's do it. No. Who's bringing it?
There we go.
For those of you who are interested in my brand or what I'm doing, I'm on lizogumba.com.
There we go. Any plugs while we're doing this? Ben, anything you want to plug?
My hair eventually, I guess.
Oh, shit. I've heard A.B. de Villiers is a good guy to talk to. Yeah.
He does look a little A.B. de Villiers-esque, doesn't he?
I don't know if that's good or bad. All right, let me do the unnews for you this morning and wrap it up. What a powerful panel. Thank you all for making some time for us this Friday morning. It's exciting. The weekend is finally here. You can take some time out. Toby, how's the kid?
Spectacular.
Yeah, there we go. New dad.
Ah.
As of a couple of months ago.
9 months this week.
Wow. 9 months?
Yeah.
Sure. Look at you.
He's listening to Cliff Central as we speak.
Well, he's got taste and style.
Yeah, it's what we do to get him to go to sleep.
His father's son. Oh, to get him to sleep. Thanks very much. Get out of here. Get out of my studio. Vladimir Putin has delivered his version of the State of the Nation address to the Russian people. The big highlight was he has now got nuclear weapons that can destroy Florida. This naturally angered Americans. Donald Trump said, "Don't panic. Nuking Florida is just a fun Russian euphemism for going on a holiday." Putin quickly responded by saying he built Sochi for holidays. Florida's for nuking. Facebook are now making it possible for you to apply for a job on their platform. Mark Zuckerberg says this is a necessary step to make the platform even more appealing to users. But we all know he's just doing this so he can gather more information on you. Lizards feed on information, and for Mark, the more personal the information, the tastier it is. And finally, Rossi Erasmus says preparation for the Box 2018 season is pretty much sorted. Odd, considering he was the only appointed as coach yesterday, but Rossi says he was born for the job, and he finds it comes easy to him. Not because he was sort of given the job last year already. That's not true. No one believes that. We will see you on Monday. Have an excellent weekend. Thank you very much, George. Thank you, Liz. Thank you, Toby. Thank you to you this morning. Catch up with you on Monday.
This is CliffCentral.com.